This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Saturday Magazine, sponsored by Velocity Rewards,
the award-winning loyalty program for Virgin Australia's frequent flyers.
Right now is one of the most important times in the 26-year history of Joy. Times are tough financially, but that will never stop us from delivering powerful, meaningful and uplifting radio for you. To get ready for the future, we're launching Joy Nation and we need your support to do it. So help Joy by asking your workmates, your next-door neighbour, your mum, your dad, your siblings and of course your friends. Go to joy.org.au and make a donation to build Joy Nation. Joy. Your voice, your radio station.
A unique mix of world news and queer culture. Saturday Magazine. Every Saturday, 10 till 12 on Joy 94.9.
Listening to Saturday Magazine with Macca and Tass. Now, do we have John on the line, Paul? Good morning, John Posito. How are you? Are you there, John? Sorry, we'll keep talking, Tass. We've just had a phone connection problem with John. What we wanted to talk to John about, amongst other things, was the Australian Federal Police raid on a journalist's house and the impact that that has for press freedom, but also, it has some wider implications. Good morning, John. How are you?
Macca, Tass, how are you both?
Oh, look, we're good. Morning. We're good. We've got over Easter and managed to buy some cheap Easter eggs on Monday, so that was great. I love that, getting it cheap.
I'm not over Easter yet because I get the best of both worlds because Betty's of a Greek background, so we get to celebrate it at home, but tomorrow all again after last week.
Well, Tass hasn't done his red eggs yet. I think he needs to be punished.
Have you ever won?
Now,
one
Macca,
of those,
you may not know this, but my name actually means resurrection, and I celebrate my name day tomorrow, Easter Sunday.
Oh, congratulations!
There you go.
Resurrection. So you're going to rise tomorrow, Tass?
Yeah, baby. Yeah.
John,
I've made a point of actually getting up in the morning, Macca, and showering and shaving like I ordinarily would, and wearing clothes. So I'm not hanging around in tracky dacks or dressing gown like you would expect me to do on a regular weekend.
Well, last time we spoke with John, he said he was wearing a T-shirt and tracky dacks. I hope you've geared up a bit today, John.
Well, you saw. I think I sent you something before. So there's visual proof that I have dressed for the occasion.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Now, look, we wanted to talk to you, John. The High Court... and you're probably more across the judgment than me in a technical sense. They ruled that the warrant that the Australian Federal Police used to raid Annika Smethurst, a News Corp journalist, was invalid or not sufficient in its description. Is that how you'd describe it?
Yeah, that's right. So not only did it misstate the offence on which the warrant purported to be based, but it also misunderstood the nature of the section of the Crimes Act, which then existed. So there were some technical arguments around it all, but the long and short of it, as you say, it was just invalid on that basis. The court didn't go into the broader issues of whether warrants like that, assuming it had even been valid, breached the implied freedom of political communication that the High Court over the last sort of three decades or so has implied into the Constitution. So those broader issues weren't dealt with, but technically it fell over. It's pretty embarrassing, I would imagine, for the law enforcement agencies involved.
Now, the outcome of that is that the evidence that the AFP gained, most of it, I understand, digital in nature, off phones and computers, has been quarantined and they cannot use that until they're allowed to use it. Now, I believe they've asked the court, or they're trying to get clarification as to whether it has to remain quarantined
or can they use it? I would have thought if the warrant was valid, well, the evidence they've gathered is not permissible. So
that's the first principle, yeah.
So it's, you know, the evidence is sitting there on a hard drive somewhere. It can't be accessed. The AFP are trying to seek a resolution of this so they can use the evidence. What does this all mean, John, for, you know, for media being able to protect their sources and for the ability of the media, independent media, and journalists to be able to hold government and particularly the security agencies to account for their actions?
Yeah, look, it's a really good question. Probably have to start it a few layers back. Is the first thing is, as we've just mentioned, the court struck down the warrants in effect on technical grounds. So we don't have any clarification on whether these types of warrants engage these broader issues around press freedom. The constitutional arguments that the lawyers for Anarchist Methodist and effectively News Corp raised were not dealt with in the court explicitly. Knocked that down. There's the not refused it, but didn't deal with it. The other question about whether the information that had been seized pursuant to the warrant ought to have been either returned or destroyed, the court split on that, and basically it remains with the authorities. So the question, as you pointed out, is what then can that information be used to achieve in a hearing? I'm of the school that, given that the warrants were invalid, it'll be very difficult, if not impossible, for any prosecution, were one to be instituted, that they could rely on it, frankly. But there's also the question of what the Federal Attorney General will do in this case as well, because my understanding is that he will need to sign off on anything. And my intuition is that I don't think we'll see a prosecution in this case. And I think that would be obviously a great relief to the journalists involved, but we're going to still have to deal with the broader issues about what sort of role media has when a warrant has been issued before it's executed. And that we're no closer to that as a result of the High Court decision. I'm you know, as pleased as I think most people are that Anarchist Methodist succeeded in the case, that she's a first-rate journalist. But there's a whole other, you know, bank of journalists who will be sweating on this as well going forward when they receive information. So these broader questions will need to be dealt with, and we're no closer to it.
John, what do you think this means for freedom of speech and freedom of media?
The decision itself doesn't help us, unfortunately, but what I'm hoping will happen as a result of this week is that it will prompt a bit more attention and work. And unfortunately, with COVID-19, it's put so many issues on the back burner. We've got an inquiry looking into this at a federal level, which hasn't yet reported. Presumably, it will contain some options and recommendations going forward. But, you know, I think we've still got to grapple with this balance, frankly, between the rule of law, which is not a principle or an argument you can easily dismiss. We can't have a free-for-all, in my view, where people can use information if they're embedded in an agency and just give it out. But equally, we can't pretend that the ability of media to report on either corrupt practices or abuses of power or incompetence can be foreclosed because they don't have the capacity to report on those things. I do think there needs to be movement on this. I don't think the status quo is plausible. We aren't going to have to move on this.
I mean, the challenge here, John, is that you know, inquiries that are ongoing, and whether, you know, what the government, you know, they've Christian Porter has made a number of statements about this in the past. You know, that the AFP really need to lift their game, and etc. We actually need some clearly defined rules around this. I was interested as we're talking COVID-19, John. How you thought federal and state governments were coping with the management. And I want to preface that by saying we're all concerned about the number of infections and particularly, obviously, the deaths from the Ruby Princess. I don't know if you recall, on March 15, the Prime Minister said that the docking and departing of passenger ships from Australia was a responsibility of Australian Border Force. That's what he said. And on the 19th of April, the ship docked. Now, you know, this parcel has been passed around. You know, New South Wales, I think, have got three inquiries going. You've got the coroner, you've got the New South Wales Police Commissioner, and you've got a former QC or judge also leading an inquiry, which apparently is going to go on for months and months and months, probably in the hope we all forget. But how do you think federal and state governments are handling COVID-19, and particularly some of the issues people are raising concerns about around civil liberties?
Yeah, it's definitely getting harder. I think I wrote about this 2 or 3 weeks ago, that I think in the early stages of this crisis, we were all, and to a large extent still are, you know, very united in, yes, there have to be, you know, fairly unprecedented measures to deal with this. But as it's evolved, I think we can all see now that the public has a more willing appetite to challenge decisions. And that's a healthy part of our democracy, and it's a healthy reflection of the way we are. But governments have to keep up with this, I think, and I mean this at state and federal governments, that I can understand at one level people who bear enormous responsibilities for important decisions, you know, feel like they need to be able to just get on and do what they need to do. And I don't doubt their motives, but they need to be more cognizant of the fact that the longer this goes on, the more people are going to want that kind of testing of ideas. It's one of the reasons why I've argued, and I know many others have as well, that, you know, Parliament should be sitting as often as it reasonably can in the current circumstances. And I think over the last sort of 48 hours, or admittedly over an issue of golfing here in Victoria, but it's just taken over the debate. And there were mixed messages yesterday coming out of the State Department. So I think governments need to understand that they, yes, we all understand they're dealing with incredibly momentous decisions, but frankly, to keep the public committed to the common objectives we should all share, you've actually got to go out of your way to show that you're listening, you're allowing for testing of those ideas and debates, particularly where there are enormous restrictions. And because of the crisis, we perhaps haven't taken stock of just how extensive and thorough those restrictions are, but they're enormous, really. The fact that we're talking, John, I think, in different locations on the phone, testament to it.
John, this is a great segue into a topic that Macra and I have been already debating this morning, which is the issue around the federal government's proposed new contact tracing app. The idea is that we all, as citizens of our nation, will choose to actually download this app and switch it on, which means that some of our movements can be monitored and checked upon, and all with the view to helping to minimise the spread of coronavirus. So I'm sure you've heard about it. There's been a lot of discussion in the media about it. What are your reflections on this?
Oh, this is a really tough one, because I really want to contribute to the effort to flatten the curve. And I can understand all of that, understand the compelling argument in favour of using it if our principal aim is to drive down transmission rates, get all of that. But boy, am I really, really unsettled by where we're heading on some of this stuff, because these are extensive tracking applications, and I welcome that it's voluntary, and I'm not saying I wouldn't necessarily do it, guys. I think what I'd say is my main point, and it sort of ties into something I said earlier, is if we're going to do this, and if the health officials are going to back this and say by doing this we can continue to suppress transmission rates, that will be an important factor in my decision and those in my family. But I also want to hear a bit about safeguards around the use of these applications. This is critical information, and I presume that the information will be closely stored, access to it will be strictly limited. You would imagine all of those things to give authorities the benefit of the doubt. But if the information about people's movements and contacts and the like were available to third parties for whatever purposes, if somehow it ended up in those hands, imagine what consequences might flow from that. I'm not just talking about security issues. I'm talking about you know, basic marketing information. Now, I presume that that's not going to happen here, to be fair, but I'd like to hear and would feel a lot more comforted if there were some comments around some of those things. Because for someone like me, I consider myself a classical liberal. I want to commit, as I said, to all of these efforts and play my part. But I also want to hear about the safeguards around some of this. And if in my case, there is enough disclosure around what those safeguards will be, well, then it will give me some comfort and I may well do it. As I said, I want to contribute to that effort.
John, this is sort of another segue into another issue that I wouldn't mind exploring with you, and that is around scrutiny and scrutiny of the sorts of decisions that our governments are making. So, you know, we've now got governments saying they want to scrutinise some of our movements and our behaviours, but what does this mean for our governments themselves? You know, where is the scrutiny around their decision-making, and where is the scrutiny around what they're doing? Who's asking questions about their decisions? What are your views about some of that?
Yeah, Tess, it's really important. And I think governments have to be proactive in their space. And as I said before, not just assume that we're bearing the world's problems on our shoulders and just let us make our decisions. I don't think that is a desirable or wise course. They've got to expect scrutiny. They've got to welcome scrutiny. And that means, as far as possible, allowing Parliament to sit. I get that you can't have full numbers and you have to use quorum arrangements and standing order arrangements to try and reduce the number of MPs who are actually needed to attend. I get all of that, but don't tell me that Parliament can't sit. And in Victoria's case, I think we've got one sitting, I think this week, or it might be next week. And that's okay, but we need regular sittings of Parliament, even with reduced numbers, to test all of this. Committees being able to work, albeit remotely, being able to test propositions. And we also need governments and agencies to confide a bit more in us. I think the longer this thing goes on and the longer these restrictions persist, it's really important that we start to see some of the modelling, some of the projection and different options that are available, because you can see it now, guys, can't you? But a lot of the debates now, particularly, as I said before, in the last sort of 24, 48 hours, you've seen decisions on canoeing and kayaking be released. You've seen mixed messages on golf, to take one example. We've had in the last couple of weeks issues around learner drivers. People, as they become more frustrated with having to stay at home and self-confine and isolate, they're wanting to know, well, what can we do? And if you want the public's confidence to be maintained, you've got to actually take the public into your confidence. I think that's
so, John,
really important.
John, I'm just going to interrupt again because I know Macca wants to ask you a question. But see, we're actually watching each other on FaceTime. There's a bit of a delayed reaction, but it sort of works. I think it works. We keep the conversation going as far as possible. Look, I'm very conscious that our federal government's been cancelled right through till September. I'm not sure that estimates committees are meeting. I'm not sure where the scrutiny of federal government policies may be. I mean, we do have an active media, but even that has been very much thwarted. I'm very concerned about that. We do live in a democracy. Yes, we have to balance people's rights with our movements and our ability to actually manage this disorder, but it really is a problem, don't you think?
I do think Parliament's need to sit, and I think federally we had a sitting, I think, 2 weeks ago, memory serves well, getting the tapes mixed up possibly. I think there's a sitting scheduled for August. As I said, Victoria's Parliament will sit for one day this week. So I think they're starting to hear it, but I think we need more of it, definitely, and particularly to handle some of the debates that are coming around, not only the restrictions we've been talking about, you know, what can you do, what can't you do, but we haven't even started the big debate about how we revive and resuscitate industries and sectors of the economy as those restrictions start to be released. And there's room for reasonable minds to differ on all of these matters, which means it's really important to hold those forums, to have committees being able to test. And I think at both federal and state levels around the country, committees
John,
now are
a,
still operating.
I've just, I've just had a message from a trusted confidant who says, in Victoria, we have not missed a single day of Parliament yet. In fact, the emergency sitting this Thursday is an extra sitting, and Parliamentary Accounts and Estimates Committee will be given additional references to Mater and Quiz ministers and their departments. So it's good to hear that the Victorian government is actually taking scrutiny seriously and its accountability back to the people.
I think the sitting of Parliament is good. I think there was some concern a couple of weeks ago because for the first time in a while it had been adjourned without a date. But in fairness, our Parliament is sitting this week, and that's a good thing. I welcome that. In fact, I think the more we serve that, the better around the country, frankly.
Now, John, I wanted to come back to this tracing app and a little bit of background here. It's based on the Singapore app, which was taken up by about 20% of the population. Little interesting technical fact. Where you are, John, speaking on your phone, the security services can already, within about 20 metres, ascertain from that phone tower and by multiplying that signal, identify where you are. They can also, excuse me, know who else is on that, connected via that phone tower. So that information about who's around you, perhaps not in absolute, social distancing measures, this is already known. I believe the reason, number one, I don't trust our security services with the information. They've let us down too many times before. But I think the reason for this is a little bit of an unusual idea, is as people get crankier and crankier about the restrictions, the government wants to maintain them, and they've said the only way they're going to reduce those restrictions is when they know that community transmission is reduced and a whole range of other issues. I see this as the whole idea of this phone app is to say, unless we can reduce transmission, unless we know where people are, we're not going to be able to reduce the restrictions. So let's all load down the app. Everyone, the security service will know where you all are. The contract tracing is really important. But there's another, there's a technical and medical reason why this is a good idea. But I actually see a little bit of PR spin going on here. Let's throw this out there as something that people really don't want. And if you don't want it, stay indoors, basically. Now, they haven't said that, but that's what I see as part of the reasoning of this. I might be wrong, I might be cynical, but the fact that they want us to download it says to me they want the information, and there are good, valid reasons for wanting it. But the question is, John, do you trust the security services with the information? Do you trust that government will turn this off when we're through this virus? Because we won't know whether they have or haven't, because it'll be like witness jail, whatever. It'll probably be a national security matter. So if you talk about it, you'll end up in jail.
Yeah, look, I don't know about the theory you've posited. I would err on the side of governments being presented with options and having been involved, not in something as momentous as this, but in other examples where it's put to government ministers and senior officials that, look, here are your options, people. If you want to get the rate or outcomes down to zero, you can do this.
Yeah.
And if everybody follows this, you'll get it down to zero in a second, but it comes at a huge price. And I think there's a mixture of that going on here, that I can only imagine that the government is getting this advice, and from what I've spoken to, this is what's happened to people I've spoken to, this is what's happened. But governments are getting the advice that if you want to reduce it, then these are measures, they're unprecedented, they come at an enormous cost to individual liberties, and encumbrances upon people's privacy and the like. But if you want to drive down those rates, you can go here and you'll do it, There'll be a guarantee almost of, as much as you can get a guarantee of driving those numbers down. That's what I think is probably at play here. I don't know if there's any other, auxiliary kind of objectives around that. But it goes back to what I said before in my view about where are the safeguards?
Yeah.
Where is it stated about when this information, will it be destroyed? Will all of the data that's collected during this period, and let's say I do what I said before, and I said, oh, look, I'll err on the side of downloading the app if those safeguards are in. Will they tell us that it will all be destroyed? And if so, when? They're the safeguards I want to know about.
Well, I don't think... I you know my view on that. Look, just before we go, a little bit of something
about... Macca, would you download the app yourself, Macca?
I'm 50-50 on that, Tass. They already know where I am.
John, what about yourself?
They already know where I am.
What about yourself, John?
Yeah, as I said before, I'm very nervous. I would probably do it, but what I want to see are the safeguards.
Yeah.
And whether that comes out of parliamentary debate, I want some assurance that this information will be destroyed and it will be closely stored and with access very limited. Those sorts of things will assure me. I'll probably do it because I want to contribute to the effort. I get what it's all about, but I want those safeguards, and I deserve them. You do too.
Let's make a suggestion, Tass, hang on. I suggest to the federal government, if they want to do this, John Pesutto would be the person to run it to make sure that the data is secure, it's not shared with people who shouldn't get it. Probably be a bit of a good earner, John.
I'd do it gratis, but the question is whether I can do it.
Yeah.
My entire...
I've got to handle the governance issues.
My entire social media network has given a resounding no.
Yes.
To this question. So I wonder whether that's just my network or whether that's a lack of confidence in our federal government or
both.
The intentions behind this. I don't know, Macca.
Unreconstructed keyboard lefties. There you go.
Now, look, Macca, before we run out of time,
we have to ask about Malcolm Turnbull. We have to ask about Malcolm Turnbull. I loved his comment.
I don't expect you've read the book yet. John.
I've read some of the extracts. There's a big one in, I think David Crowe's got a big piece, which I haven't yet read. So I've got that after this to read. But it'll certainly take our mind off COVID-19.
Well, I've ordered a copy, and I love one of the quotes, though, that about Barnaby Joyce, that he took a traditional view of marriage, but also practiced traditional adultery.
But what do you actually think? This is a really interesting question about what former national and state leaders, or political leaders for that matter, is it worth the contribution to posterity to ignite these kind of debates? And whilst I can understand people wanting to commit their own version of events to paper like this, I wonder whether it leaves your legacy diminished or enhanced. I really do.
Well, one wonders about the timing, and I agree there. I think, you know, the time was set, obviously, before COVID-19. The book, my understanding is the first print run of about 45,000 is sold out, most of them probably in Parliament House in Canberra. Perhaps your colleague, Tim Smith, he might have bought one, take his mind off golf or something, perhaps, but...
I'm not sure he would have bought it.
No. So I think, it's a tell-all. I've bought a copy because I do want to read it, but I've also, you know, I buy a lot of these sort of books because I find it interesting. I think the challenge is going to be, does it diminish his legacy? Well, some might say his legacy was already diminished. You know, Malcolm has a very interesting history in terms of what he's done and what he's achieved. A lot of us are disappointed with what he did achieve and what he didn't achieve. But I think a tell-all book, is interesting, but it's certainly... I don't think he's going to get invited to anything at the Lodge currently, that's for sure. Well, not with social distancing, but beyond that, I don't see him visiting the Lodge or Kirribilli anytime soon for a cuppa.
Yeah, I respect Malcolm and I accept that he's made a call to do this. I'm just, you know, standing in my study here looking at a book. One of my favourite books is the memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant. And the reason I'm thinking of them is those memoirs are seen, I think, across the board as kind of a benchmark for what memoirs ought to do.
Yes.
And I just wonder whether Malcolm, in with his book here, and to be fair, I haven't read it, so I caveat my comments with that, do you want to leave your legacy enhanced or not? And I just don't know that this book's going to do that by the time it's been digested broadly by the hungry politics reading
John, let's save that one for a further discussion until after you've read the book. And Mac has read the book. I probably won't read the book. I've got enough policy briefs to read. That keeps me busy enough these days. But
this is more a fable, Tess.
I will look forward to a facilitated discussion between the pair of you on Malcolm Turnbull's memoirs. John, thank you very much for your time this morning. It's always great to have you on the airwaves.
Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9, proudly sponsored by Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.